Hey, Kristen here. Thanks so much for listening to Election Intrigue, the podcast. Today's a fun one because we are getting in that period of time where it's less than 2 weeks away from the election. So much of what John and I have been reading, talking to different sources about, and thinking about for much of the past year is reaching, you know, the big day, election day. But what we seem to find and what we've been talking to and what we'll talk about today is just because November 5th comes and rolls around, there's still the time between November 5th and the election, which we saw in 2020 is critical and critical for the American people to trust, believe, and oblige with the results of the election. So we'll dive right into that and some other themes as the campaigns are solidifying their last messages to the American people. And another plug for our daily flagship newsletter, International Intrigue, which comes out every weekday morning, catching you up on what you need to know on what happened around the world in the past 24 hours. Just today, Friday morning, we had a great look at the BRICS summit, which just wrapped up in Russia, and it coincided with a lot of other summits. We had IMF in Washington, D.C., which we also covered this week, and elections around the corner in many different places in the world, like Moldova and the Mozambique election just happening. So all of that is in the daily flagship newsletter. All right, let's dive right in to Election Intrigue, the podcast. John, well, I have lots of energy today because we're fresh off an intrigue event from last night. So I'm looking forward to chatting with all my DC event energy.
I know. I was sad not to be able to make it down to DC for the event. It looked awesome on cybersecurity. We had DARPA folks there. All the people who are, these are the kinds of people who don't make headlines, but are actually changing the world.
Yeah. Well, and they're really critical for people in the DC ecosystem to meet, right? Like, you don't really go to an event to hear what's happening on the panel. You go for when they get off the panel to chase them down and be like, wait, elaborate on that.
Yeah. That's one of the, I think if I go back to my days in kind of being a diplomat or even before that in university, I wish I'd realized that early. You don't go to listen to what they say. You go up to them afterwards and go, that was so interesting. Anyway, here's my business card. Let's have coffee. It took me a while to learn that.
Or to the person next to you. Yeah.
Right. I'm a slow learner. Let's crack on today, Kristen. We've got a lot to talk about. We're like, how many days? Not many. Less than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
12 days. My God, from the election. What are we going to do with ourselves? We're going to like have good sleep and peaceful conversations with people.
Yeah, someone was asking that to me last night, one of our readers. They were like, I love your guys' newsletter. I will say it's packed with so much information that I have to start it and come back to it when I genuinely can read and think about it. And they're like, but what am I going to do when you're not telling me what's happening with the election? So I was like, you're asking me.
Everyone's going to take deep breaths and relax. All right, let's crack on. So I want to talk firstly about what I'm calling Harris's closing argument to the American people. Then we'll talk about some foreign interference. I think I've said before, Kristen, that I'm pretty worried about post-election to inauguration period. In some ways, much less worried about the actual result of the election. And then we'll do a, you know, we had a bunch of topics we want to talk about, but I think we're going to do a roundup of other news just because there's a bunch of little things that happened this week that I think are worth pulling on, but probably not enough for a whole conversation in itself. So let's crack on. Big news this week, I think, is that there's been an obvious and very clear shift from the Harris campaign. From, you know, we were in Chicago for the Democratic National Convention, which was her coming out party, her debutante ball, or whatever you want to call it. And it was just joy, right? It was like party vibes. Oh, she's the joyful candidate. They're backfighting. It's going to be awesome. They've changed that, and the campaign's messaging now is much darker, and it's much more Trump is a threat to democracy. It kind of happened sometime over the last week, but did you notice that shift as well?
I noticed it. I will say I also noticed it as she started to go down in the polls. So
yeah,
it seemed there was a market shift.
That's a really interesting point. We'll talk about what they've said this week, but I think that is a really interesting point because I've been trying to figure out whether this was, you know, they've got David Plouffe and Jen O'Malley-Dillon, who are Hall of Fame campaign strategist. So I'm kind of wondering whether this was always the goal, like introduce Harris, get her vibes across the American people as a joyful warrior kind of person. And then as the election gets closer, you've kind of introduced her to the electorate. You've won all the votes for people who didn't know who she was. And now it's time to remind people who Trump is, because people have forgotten, I think. I think it's true that people have forgotten from 2016 to 2020, he was a fairly divisive character. Or to your point, whether they're like, oh boy, she's in trouble. Let's hammer the old tried and true negative campaigning.
Yeah, it's probably a mix of the two. It has been interesting to see her say at an interview when she was asked if Trump was a fascist, like throwing around the word fascist is a big deal. I'm not saying that she flew it around flippantly, but for that to be dialogue in a campaign is a big deal and should be treated lightly. So that felt like that interview was a market shift to me.
Yeah. So she gave, I think you're talking particularly about the CNN town hall, right? Which was Wednesday night, if I'm not mistaken, where she basically said he's a fascist. But more than that, Kristen, you know this well, there's been a flurry of news articles. The Atlantic has published stuff. John Kelly gave an interview, and this is all coordinated by the campaign. So John Kelly, Donald Trump's, I think his first or at least his longest serving chief of staff, gave a series of interviews basically saying, he was asked, would you call him a fascist? And he said, well, the definition of fascism is X, Y, Z. So yes, I think it's fair. So you've got the guy who worked in the Oval Office with Trump saying, yes, I think he's a fascist. Then you had an Atlantic article drop basically saying that Trump said, oh, I need to get myself some of Hitler's generals, which is self-explanatory and problematic. And I don't think there's a lot of context around that I can give that makes it sound like he was taken out of context. It sounded like he appreciated the fact that, you know, it's the classic argument of like, well, authoritarians can get stuff done. And that's what Trump was saying. And then lastly, you had Mark Milley, who was Trump's joint chief of staff chairman, head of the military in the Trump administration, infamous for his role in the January 6th stuff and for the Lafayette Square protest issue that happened in the late days of the Trump administration. He also came out and said that he found Trump to be unfit for office because of these things. So there was this flurry of news articles, right?
Right. And exactly. I had asked a friend who's just a diehard Harris supporter, you know, Cat Women for Harris sign in the front yard. And I said, you know, what do you make of this? Right. It does bring the campaign to sort of an additional level if you are throwing around fascism. And she was like, well, it's not like Harris just said this out of the blue, exactly to your point. Like there's been a series of articles, there's been these interviews. And so it's essentially like, and she really responded to a question at the town hall. She didn't kind of start with that. So yeah, I mean, it's a mixture. It does seem like this is probably a point in the campaign where they've realized there's no, you know, they're never going to get someone who's going to vote for Trump or leaning towards Trump, because that kind of language is polarizing, right? And so it seems like it's the shift is more so also that they know they're talking to their base, and it's that turnout that we've spoken to in previous weeks.
So you think the argument is this will help turn out her base, or you think it will stop moderates from turning out for Trump?
I think that her base, it's like that's giving them reason to think, no, I need to make this a priority, and I do really need to show up because it is such a critical election, as she's telling me.
That's interesting. I don't disagree with you. I wonder if it's, I don't know. I'm not an American, and I don't vote in the election. I wonder how compelling that is, because it's a drumbeat that we have been hitting for so long in the media that, oh, Trump is dangerous. He's fascist. He's a big fan of Putin. He's a big fan of Kim Jong-un and Orban and all these other authorities. I mean, I think it's pretty well established that Trump in his fever dreams would be a an authoritarian, it strikes me that things that will get her base out are things like, and we're not going to talk about this because we're not a domestic focused political podcast, but things like abortion, things like peaceful transfer of power. And I suppose that is related, but more issues that hit working Americans who might decide this election in places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, or Michigan versus this existential, fairly elite level threat. Like, this is not a conversation that I don't think people are having across their dinner tables in Iowa. Like, oh, what is the state of fascism in the world? They're not talking about that, in my view.
Yeah. I think it really dials into just that one point where it's this peaceful transition to power. I think most Americans don't, you know, most people of most states, nation states around the world don't want to see an election then turn into chaos and another January 6th, where, you know, it just feels like there's so much out of control and there's contention. And so I think that that is, you know, I agree that probably, like, you know, in dinner tables, even in, you know, the suburbs of New York City, maybe, right? Like, people aren't just like, let's talk about fascism today, generally. And so, yeah, I don't think that it's, you know, but it feeds into this idea, and they're saying it in more words than just that of like, it could be, this could be concerning of him not accepting losing the election, Trump being, you know, and so there's that.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it is kind of like a coded way to talk about all that stuff without boring people about January 6th. Again, you got to be very careful about indexing on your own preferences because you have your own preferences and the rest of the country don't have your preferences. And too many commentators on the news, including us, will go like, oh, well, he needs to do this or she needs to do this because that's what I want them to do. But having said that, that's exactly what I'm going to do and say, I found her at her most compelling. I find the Democrats at their most compelling in this election when they are taking up the old Republican place, space on the electoral kind of spectrum of saying America's a great place. Donald Trump literally gives speeches where he tells them everyone America is going to hell. America has its problems. You can't deny the fact that, you know, the economy, a lot of people are worried about inflation and prices and all. You can acknowledge the things that are real without saying America's a shithole. And that's, I found that the most compelling place when she was like, I'm proud to be an American and we're going to make it better. The Barack Obama argument of we're not perfect, but we're all striving to be that. I find that more a compelling kind of rebuke of Donald Trump's negativity. And, you know, again, this is not a partisan argument. That is objectively his approach to political argumentation is under the last 4 years, this country's going to hell. I'll be the one to bring it back. The most effective rebuttal of that to me is to say, no, it's not. We've got problems, but don't you dare be negative about this country. It's the greatest place in the world. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if the fascism thing works.
Right. Yeah. I don't know either. I also think, as we've said, like, people already know which way they're leaning.
Yes, absolutely. Before we leave this, I read, and I think we'll put it in the newsletter, in the what we're reading section, I read a fascinating interview, again, almost certainly coordinated by the campaign, the Harris campaign, to get it out there this week, but a fascinating interview with a historian whose name escapes me, which is not great, but he is a very famous historian who wrote on Vichy France, wrote the kind of, I guess, the gold standard exploration of Vichy France. And what he did was he basically reversed the French mythology in the years after the war that they were kind of like forced to collaborate with the Nazis. They had no choice. And, they were a nation of resistors, but for the jackboot of the Nazis. And he wrote this book in, I think it was in the 70s, basically saying that's nonsense. Vichy France collaborated actively. You know, people were thrilled to get jobs with Nazi Germany. They were thrilled to send arms and food and all this kind of stuff to Nazi Germany. He essentially said, and he's a world expert on fascism. And I thought it was a very nuanced conversation with him because he said, I was very reticent to call, and he doesn't call Trump a fascist. He calls the MAGA movement has elements of fascism. He said in the 2016 election cycle and the 2020 election cycle, I was reticent to say that because it didn't have the same characteristics as the fascism that I've studied throughout the 20th century. But he said now the MAGA movement has fascist tendencies. But very interestingly, he said, I don't think it's a politically smart message to say it. So he was asked two questions. Do you think MAGA is fascist? Do you think it's politically smart to say so? He said, yes and no. And I find that very interesting because it's this idea, again, that I think the Democrats and the left media and left-wing people generally don't understand about the 2024 or 21st century media ecosystem is the more you bang a message in the past, the more people get it in their head. The more you bang a message now, the more people ignore it. They hear it. They know you've said it. They remember it. They don't care anymore. You degrade the threat. You cry wolf. And obviously the lesson of the boy who cried wolf fable parable isn't that the wolf doesn't exist. It's just that you can't keep saying it exists if you, you know, if you don't want people just to tune out. And that's kind of, I think, why I'm skeptical of the fascism argument is just, I think people, if you said to people, oh, have you heard him be called a fascist? Yeah. Are you worried about it? No. And that's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say the kind of last thing on this of as an American voter who has family members who vote Republican, I found that, you know, at first, like back in 2020, I thought that those kind of things could, those, you know, this, oh, he's going to ruin the country or whatnot, you know, would maybe they would like to see that kind of thing to kind of hear both sides of it. But I think you're like, it doesn't matter to people have already made their mind up. And that's to say, it's not to say that it like, this should be the end all be all argument and someone then shouldn't get the fair right to vote for whatever party or candidate they want to.
Totally. And again, I promise this is the last thing because we could bang on about this forever, but it's not the end of the conversation. You can say a political movement has fascist tendencies, but that's not unique in history. I mean, we've had the UK had Oswald Mosley in the 1920s, where genuine like brown short kind of, you know, fascist marching about the streets of the UK, and they defeated them. You know, you've got Marine Le Pen in France. You've got the folks in Italy, the Five Star Movement, all these kinds of folks. Maybe they're not fascist. Maybe they're not fully fascist. I mean, you literally have Benito Mussolini's granddaughter in Italian politics saying that fascism is a good thing. So this, it's not like this doesn't exist elsewhere. And it's also not like the American system doesn't build in checks and balances for this. Like he knows this from his first term. If he's elected, it'll be really hard to do some of the things he wants to do. Maybe a little easier than the first term, but he's still not going to walk in there and institute, you know, fascist policies from day one. So my point is, I think the Democrats miss a trick when they start applying terms to people, because I think they mistake that people don't care about those terms. And secondly, America's more resilient than you think. I don't think Donald Trump is necessarily going to be great for those kinds of democratic ideals. But I also think that the argument is a little bit overdone. All right, let's move on to something else. Let's move on to proper fascists and Vladimir Putin and North Korea and Iran and all these folks. So this, we want to talk about foreign interference. There was a big report that came out this week. I don't think it said anything really new, Kristen. It kind of just said Russia, Iran, I don't know if it mentioned North Korea, but it basically said the classic, what I call the Confederacy of Chaos countries are doing things to interfere in the election. They are using generative AI to post content across social media and to email. We had reports also this week, or maybe it was late last week, that a lot of stories that haven't been picked up by the US media about Tim Walz apparently sexually assaulting people were completely fabricated by a propaganda unit in the Russian Secret Service, the GRU. And by Secret Service, I don't mean protect the president. I mean like intelligence services. So we have this drumbeat of people within foreign intelligence apparatuses trying to sow chaos in the US election. Did anything from the report stand out to you as new or interesting?
Yeah, well, they specifically looked at the period of time after Election Day to Inauguration Day. And as you pointed out at the very beginning, I think of when we started talking, is that actually is starting to feel like the really critical moment, because – whatever happens right on election day, there's so many reasons for bases to potentially not believe the results. That's what's becoming the concern. And that's in this report, what they brought out is they said they have learned. So this Confederacy of Chaos, Iran, Russia, China, who have some sort of vested interest in potentially the U.S. not being a hegemon, they have learned from 2020 of that critical period between election day and inauguration day. And if there's any information that you can get out there that gives voters reason to discredit the system, that is extremely salient. And they saw that in 2020, and that's what the report is really concerned about, that they learned enough lessons, not, you know, exactly what you said. It's a very resilient country. It doesn't mean things are going to, you know, go haywire, but there is maybe potential for more misinformation flow.
Yeah. And I think what we see here is, I don't know if we've talked about it on Election Intrigue. We've certainly talked about it in International Intrigue, our flagship newsletter. Anyone who's not signed up for that, go do that right now. But we've talked about this policy or this strategy. No, it's not even a strategy. It's the tactic of the new CIA director. Again, he's not new anymore. I've got to like keep up with the times. He's been there for, what, 3+ years now. But Bill Burns, former diplomat, he has this tactic of what I've called pre-bunking, which is the idea that when Russia was about to invade the Ukraine, he kind of went to Moscow and said, we know you're going to do it. Don't do it. Oh, okay. Well, you're going to do it, but we're going to get in front of you and announce to the world classified information that is credible so that when it happens, when you invade, it's going to be really impossible for you to pretend that it wasn't an invasion. And it worked. Like, there has never been credible belief from anywhere apart from the mouth breathers on, you know, Reddit and 4chan that Russia didn't invade Ukraine. But in 2014, when they invaded Crimea, a lot of people were like, well, maybe they didn't. Like, so it's a policy that has worked. Flood the zone with credible information before something happens. So when that thing happens, you've already set the narrative around what it is. And I think that's what's happening here. I think that there's a drumbeat of this stuff. There's a Microsoft report too that came out, or a blog post that came out from their threat center saying much of the same stuff, you know, down ballot, China's having a go at down ballot races, all this kind of stuff. There's a drumbeat of this stuff because I think they want everybody to know what's going to happen. So when it happens, it's not surprising. And there's a belief in the government that foreign actors are influencing the election or trying to influence the election, because the best policy for this stuff, the best inoculation in a free democracy, is give people the information to see what's happening. You can't try to pretend it's not happening. You can't stop it. We know that you can't stop it. So just tell people it's happening and say, hey, just use your common sense.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a really good analysis. I like that. I'm just going to underscore that.
Thanks, I do it
that.
For a job.
I'm just going to take that. I'm going to start saying that, just like how you tell readers, like, take our points. Oh, I'm going to take that. I'm going to start saying that this weekend.
Yeah, if you say it in meetings and sound smart.
Right, exactly. I mean, but it's true, right? And it did really work in 2022. And it makes sense. And it also look like they're on top of things.
It does. And it also, there's also a signaling of this stuff too, to the bureaucracy, because I was reading an interview with an election official who said, oh, since 2020, we've made huge improvements on election security. You know, we're ready for people to challenge the outcomes. We're ready for the ballot counting stuff. You know, you've talked in previous editions of this podcast and newsletter that legal challenges are being filed around the country. Election officials are already aware of that. So they are dotting their I's and crossing their T's, because at the end of the day, what matters isn't the result per se. It's that people believe the result is as robust as it possibly can be. And all of these things, all of this pre-bunking, this information goes out to send a message to, again, you're not going to convince a diehard MAGA person or a diehard, you know, socialist that the other side isn't evil, but thankfully, that's not who runs the country. That's not most people in any country at the moment. So you've got to just convince the reasonable people who are kind of normal, who just go like, wow, gee, there are questions about the US election, versus last time where people genuinely didn't believe Trump. And that's why he didn't, I think, was unsuccessful in overthrowing the election, or at least questioning the results. They want to make sure that the same result happens this time, even though they think the pressure is going to be much bigger to kind of dispute the election, if you get my point.
Totally. Okay, John, I want to know about how Trump accused the UK Labour Party.
Thanks for changing. I'm on a rant this morning because this is outrageous. So this is news that went kind of around the internet started this week, that the UK Labour Party, so recently elected, I think they're 120 days into their first term of government, maybe 100 volunteers from the party, the Labour Party, so officials, I'm not sure if I've seen an MP mentioned, but perhaps, are out volunteering for Harris, knocking on doors in Pennsylvania, Michigan, in swing states, trying to help the Harris campaign. Now, they were subject of news articles, and I think the Trump campaign filed, I don't know what you do, you file a complaint, the Trump campaign went all Karen on this and complained to the manager. But like, it's an outrage, Krista. This is like, what is the Labour Party in the UK doing, allowing people to go to the US and volunteer? Now, I know it's their private time. I know that they're allowed to do whatever they want. They're, it's a free country. But like, how does the Labour Party go, like, do not go and try and change the outcome of the election? Because if Trump wins, we are the government. We cannot be seen to be working against the guy who gets elected, if he gets elected. Like, how is that not foreign interference? I'm stunned that they are defending it. Actually, there's a quote that I pulled up of the UK Defence Secretary, so a senior official, saying, "Oh, I don't know what the Trump campaign is complaining about. We sent, you know, essentially they're volunteers. We don't control them. They can do what they want. It's election season. This is just politics. It's not election season in your country, you clown."
Well, even for U.S. government officials, there's the Hatch Act. So you can't just you can just go to any old protest. You know, you need to report this stuff. You might need to take a leave of absence if you want to go work on a campaign. Like, you're not touching government.
Drawing on my legal background, there is this principle of like ostensible bias. So it's not that you are biased. It's not that you're unable to be even-handed. It's what people will perceive your actions as biased. Like, it doesn't actually matter if you're biased or not. If you go and do things in your role that look to other people like you have bias, that's the problem. Again, it goes to what we were talking about before. It doesn't actually matter what's happening. It's what people think is happening. And I don't know, like, if I was a Trump campaign official and I saw this and I get elected and I'm the director of something in the State Department, I'm furious. I'm like, we're not going to work with the UK. We're going to, you know, why don't we undermine them? Because they tried to undermine us. I'm stunned. And more than that, I'm stunned. This happens all the time, right? Like, I'm sure Australian officials have done the same thing. The US political system seems to draw everybody's attention from everywhere. But it's not that they did it so much as that the UK Labour Party's statements about it happening have been outrageous. Like, the UK Defence Secretary saying, oh, it's not a big deal. Other party officials saying, well, you know, we can't stop them. And if they were paid to do it, which, by the way, would be illegal because you're not allowed to be paid if you're a foreign citizen. If they were, you know, paid for flights or given dinners and accommodation, we didn't do it. So it's not a big deal. I can't understand. I'm outraged by it. And I can't believe Keir Starmer hasn't come out and just said, listen, I didn't know about this. And if I had, I would have stopped it because we have to, I mean, that's our closest ally. We don't interfere in their elections. We work with whoever gets elected because they are our friends. And it's outrageous.
Interesting. Yeah. I guess it probably won't. I guess they feel like they might be immune because does the UK public care about, you know, their, right? Is it going to get a reaction domestically?
No. Like, I don't think anyone in the UK cares about it, but I think that's not the point. I think the point is, the world works with allies respecting each other's electoral positions. And maybe I'm being too diplomatic and too naive, but you work with whatever government comes in. And I know that Trump is a divisive figure. Australia's had its issues with him in the past, particularly Kevin Rudd, who's now our US ambassador. When he was, I think, foreign minister in Australia, said some pretty, you know, strong things about Trump. And there's questions about whether he'll be able to work with Donald Trump. But the general principle that political people don't get involved in commenting on their allies' leadership, seems to have gone away. And maybe I'm missing a shift. Maybe I'm missing a general shift. And maybe the Trump campaign actually doesn't care. And if they win, they'll be like, oh, all's fair in love and war. We'd do the same to your election. But I don't know. It feels wrong to me. And it feels I'm just shocked that Keir Starmer isn't more ahead of this. I don't know what else to say. I mean, it's amazing what I can get worked up about, but this is one of those things where I just kind of feel like I don't know what they're playing at.
Do you think the Trump campaign could have just let it brush it under the rug to not have potentially a tough relationship with the UK coming in?
For sure. But the Trump campaign doesn't care about that. We know the Donald Trump administration is not scared to break a few noses when making a point. And I think what it does do for them, and not unfairly because it's true, is show that the US election interference isn't all one way. Like, it's not just the folks that Russia, it's not just fuck Russia, China, North Korea, all these countries who want Trump to win. Now, obviously, the two are not comparable. A couple of hundred volunteers going and knocking on doors for Kamala Harris in what is still a fundamentally democratic exercise of like trying to politely convince people to vote for someone is very different to AI generated content saying that one of the vice presidential candidates is a sex pest. Those are very different things, but that's why they will have blown it up. They will have said, this is an outrage. You know, you can't, you know, and it probably brings out their base too, because there's that anti-establishment idea of, hey, look, the left-wing elites over in the UK. And what's more of a symbol of elitism than the UK, you know, Sir Keir Starmer? He's trying to take the election away from me again. So it probably brings out the base.
All right, who the U.S. used to formerly belong to has to come help out.
We'll beat him once, we'll beat him again.
Hilarious. Okay, well, there's lots of other little bits and bobs out there this week.
Let me just take a breath to calm down from my outrage of a couple of hundred volunteers coming over from the UK.
It's really crazy. I know. Now I'm like, I wonder where they are. I want to go. I wish I could have been in a house while they knocked. That could have been cool. Like, what are you doing here?
And said, you know, poured some tea out or like, you know, get off my lawn or something.
Right, exactly. I know. I hope they took some yard signs back with them and now have them just smack dab in the middle of London. It's for fun. Cultural exchange. Okay. So in terms of other just little news this week, I mean, I was fascinated to see an Arab News poll, which is Arab News is Saudi backed, but it was Arab News and YouGov, which YouGov's, I mean, it's very big in the UK. It's, I mean, I find their polls to be reputable.
To
Yeah. And so it seems to be that Arab voters, Arab American voters, they've given Trump just a tiny, tiny, tiny lead, but in a race where there's tiny leads factor in, and that seemed to really make the splash.
Step back a second. This was a poll of U.S. voters, right? Like,
yes.
A Saudi-backed Arab newspaper that polled U.S. voters on Arab issues and who they preferred on.
Correct.
Was it Palestine? It was a bunch of different things, right?
It was which is crazy to see that shift, just because, you know, Trump was previously known for the Muslim ban. I didn't really pull very well with Arab American voters and with Muslim American voters, and now seems to be doing a little bit better.
Yeah, you've been hammering this story for months now, and I've been kind of skeptical that it will actually change the election, but you've been on it for a while saying, you never know. And I'm kind of coming around to your view. This is one of those classic ones where after 2016, when Trump was elected and everybody who's being honest with themselves thought his comments to Billy Bush, that I'm not going to repeat, but, you know, the famous comments he made about being a celebrity, everyone, if they're being honest, thought that his campaign was over when he made those comments, because you can't understand anybody voting for him after those comments. This element, this piece of news has similar vibes to me of like, I personally, if I was a Palestinian or I cared about those issues as my number one thing, I can't comprehend that you would vote for Donald Trump. But I also, because I'm not that person, I don't understand what they care about. And that has the same vibes, because I think it's fairly clear based on my analysis that Donald Trump would be a more pro-Israel, less pro-Palestinian president. So it doesn't make sense to me logically that if you care about Palestine and two-state solution or care about Palestinians in any way, that you would vote for Donald Trump. But I guess I'm missing something.
So I think it's threefold. One, a lot of these voters are turning to Jill Stein. You know, is Jill Stein going to win this election? No, I'm pretty confident saying that.
Who's backed by Republican money, right, to split the vote, just like, you know, 2016, apparently she did split the vote in key ways.
Right. So. Apparently also, and people need to look more into this, but I was talking to someone else about this yesterday, and they were like, she's backed by Russia. All of her money is from Putin, which...
I think it's widely known she was... at least partially backed by Steve Bannon in the 2016 election cycle. So she's a spoiler is what you're saying.
Right, exactly. So just going to third party, which isn't good for both major parties, Democrats or Republicans. Second, why reward a party that you believe has done underscored, supported horrific events in the Middle East? It's kind of like this idea of like, if you buy a car, you can't take the car home and then be like, actually, you know what? I wanted the upgrade. Can we talk about the upgrade? They're like, you took it off the lot. It's yours now. And so it's just a way, I think, of reasserting power. It's a power dynamic. I think ultimately voters want to feel like their vote does have power, especially if they're in these swing states and they realize how important their vote is. And then three, something I've heard actually is that I've heard that that Trump's argument of, you know, I'll have it done in 24 hours. No, scant on detail, you know, no plan. But that seems like, all right, 24 hours and it's over. Like, you know, it's been so many 24 hours, it's been over 365 days of 24 hour, you know, cycles. So if you can just end this quickly, what needs to be done? It's already been horrific.
Yeah. And here's where I'd walk back my earlier comments about not understanding someone who'd vote for Trump. Because again, I'm genuinely like, I don't have a dog in the fight and I'm pretty apolitical on this stuff. But the counter argument, which I think is reasonable, would be, listen, like the Democrats have been in charge for 3.5 years. And for, you know, 12 of the last 16, you haven't solved it. You've talked a big game, just like the southern border or whatever. Like, you've talked a big game, and just because now you acknowledge it's a big deal, you haven't solved it. And it is plausible that Donald Trump will go in, and Netanyahu, we know, likes Trump a lot more than Biden and Harris. He may do him a favor. He may say, maybe he will say, okay, we've killed Sinwa, we've killed Nasrallah, we've killed it, we've done a bunch of stuff. We're still on a war footing, but we're going to pull out of Gaza because it's time. And maybe Trump can get that stuff done. I don't know. So that's the other side, right? Like, it's like, it's kind of like a broken, you know, the definition of insanity is vote Democrat for everything and nothing changes and continuing to vote Democrat. Maybe that's the mentality.
I think that's kind of it. Also, it's like, Trump is not at all shy about his just, there is no red line for him with Israel, I would argue. And that sometimes that feels a little bit better to just be told honestly something than to exactly what you said, like just like, we're in the 100-yard line of a ceasefire. We're going to, you know, and it never happens. Well, it's well, like, you also, know what? Just get out of here.
Exactly. And when I say Trump, I think would be a less good president for the Arab Palestinian cause, I'm talking fairly long term. I'm talking structurally. I'm not convinced he'd be worse right now for Gazans who are dying under Israeli bombs. As I said, he may be able to convince Netanyahu to stop doing that. I don't know. Maybe he can. So, like, I'm talking about structurally. Like, I think long term, the Abraham Accords and all these kinds of things actually marginalizes Palestine. But, like, how many voters are going, by 2040, the things that, you know, Trump did in 2024 are the things that actually stuffed our cause? I don't know. I think a lot of people just want an end to it, and they want it off the front page, and they want the rebuilding to start. And maybe Trump is better on that. I honestly don't know. And the other thing too is just like, I don't know how, like, I think your point about how people vote is really good. It's like people say they vote this way. People say they care about this stuff. Voting is unknowable. We don't have any sense of how people are going to vote, and they could be just trying to maximize the coverage they get for their cause right now. So I don't know. This is writ large across the polls. It's writ large across interviews. There is no way of knowing. There is no data that is reliable. And so you just got to like talk about it, think about it, and then say you don't know. All right, we're running out of time, Kristen. Let's two more things I want to talk about. One is this: there seems to be an economic push from the Harris campaign to message a couple of things. One, Goldman Sachs has kind of come out and said that tariffs and all that kind of stuff will be bad for the economy. Donald Trump's tariffs will be bad for the economy. They also came out this week and said there could be a 10% drop in the euro if Donald Trump's tariffs come into place. I think they're really trying to push this idea that tariffs are not good economic policy. I think it's too late for them. I think the message isn't resonating. Yeah. I think people don't care about tariffs.
The IMF said that too this week. And people are like, yeah, okay, well, sure.
It's worrying to me though, because I think, yeah. I mean, maybe I'm a creature of 20 years ago, but tariffs to me are not a good thing. Like, we don't want a protectionist world. A protectionist world is a more dangerous world, in my view. But that seems to be the way we're going. And I don't think the Harris pushback is, I actually don't think Harris wants to push back on it, because she's not, I think she thinks it's popular, that it's a popular, it's like, hey, we should actually protect American industries from Chinese flooding the market, because China does flood the market with stuff that's cheap because they subsidize it. So that's an interesting one. I don't think it's going to resonate. Bill Gates and Jamie Dimon, so obviously Microsoft and JP Morgan. Yeah, JP Morgan. You know, billionaires came out and said that they're for Harris. They're influential guys. Interesting. I don't think it's going to move the needle either.
Which is interesting, because Diamond, was it this last World Economic Forum in Switzerland, or was it the one before, where he like sent shockwaves because he was like, it wasn't that bad under Trump. And everyone was like, whoa, Jamie Dimon, JP Morgan CEO saying that. So it's interesting.
Actually, and I should correct myself. They didn't come out and say that. It was leaked that they've had private conversations, which is the same thing, because those leaks don't happen unless they tell them. But anyway, so I found that interesting. Like, those are big players, but I don't think it's going to move the needle. And the last thing we're going to talk about, and we're going to do it very briefly if we can manage to, is Elon Musk, which of course is what he wants, because he's being ludicrous and he wants everyone to talk about what he's doing. But two things this week. One, he's giving $1 million a day to voters who sign up for a PAC. It's not clear if it's illegal. I think it probably is, but who cares? Elon Musk is not going to get in trouble for doing any of this kind of stuff. Maybe he'll have to pay a fine, but he just made $37 billion yesterday because Tesla's stock went up. So what is he going to care about in terms of a couple $100 million fine is changed down the back of the couch? But he is essentially paying people to vote for Trump, even if it's not quite that. So I found that kind of fairly outrageous. South African born, foreign interference, Kristen.
I know. I think most people don't even know he's South African. I want to say I told someone the other day,
he's
and they
American
were like,
to be fair.
Well, yes, but. You know, like, I don't like to Americans, to some Americans, it's very salient, this argument of like born in the U.S., right? You know, all of that. So,
yeah, you can't run for president.
Yeah.
So take small wins when you can get them, right? But the second thing about Musk is that, and maybe this needs more explanation than we've got time for right now, but again, reports that have come out, which are conveniently timed, about him having conversations with Putin since 2022 and acquiescing to a Russian demand to not activate Starlink in Taiwan as a favor to Xi Jinping. And in fact, I think it does need more exploration, but I have been banging on about this for a couple of years now, that Elon Musk has such geopolitical power. He, you know, he did it for good, in my view, when he activated Starlink over Ukraine during the Russian invasion. But the first rule of politics is that if someone has the power to do something that you like, they will also use that power to do things that you don't like. And therefore, those people having that power at all is generally a bad thing. And I think Musk being able to have conversations with President Putin and to do a favor to Xi Jinping, both Russian adversaries, both American adversaries, both potentially against American national interest. I think that's getting very, very close to problematic in terms of illegal statecraft. I'm not going to use the word treason, but it's like not, we're not a long way away from Elon Musk having genuine, I think genuine problems with though that I'm kind of tiptoeing around it because I don't like using those dramatic words, but it's hard for me to understand how that's not treasonous.
No, I mean, also, like, he is leading so much of space exploration. That's like the next frontier of, you know, 21st century colonization of who kind of gets space, who controls it. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible the amount of power he has on a geopolitical scale.
It is.
Yeah.
And you know, like in history, kings would have gone, right, we need to take down the most powerful private citizen because he's threatening my power.
Interesting.
Vladimir Putin himself took down the oligarchs for this very same reason. Came to power, the oligarchs had way more money, way more power than the Russian state had at that point, or arguably. So he got them in line. And I'm not saying that that's what
they started falling out of their balconies.
Out of windows, and they've been doing so ever since. And I'm not saying, to be very clear to everybody, I'm not saying that's what should happen with Elon Musk. I am saying he is in the same.
He's a genius. Like, there's
incredible.
No denying any of that, right?
And you want him in America, pushing American like innovation forward, and like you want him. But I don't know how you deal with him if he starts to pretend to be the Secretary of State.
Yeah. Well, if anyone has links to Musk, drop his number. We'll reach out.
Oh yeah, I'll say whatever I need to say about him if he wants to give me some money. I will shill if he wants to drop me a couple of mil. All right, with that, we've gone way over time, Kristen. It's close. We'll be back next week for our last pre-election edition. But until then, what's my motto right now? It's basically don't believe anything you read, but keep reading and keep being informed.
Totally.
But don't believe anything except us.
Take everything just as a data point.
Exactly. Thanks, Kristen.
All right. Thanks.